Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Hello, welcome to Breaking Banks episode 366. Today we're going to talk about central bank digital currencies. Central bank digital currencies are a hot topic worldwide with a lot of attention from regulators, the crypto community, technology enthusiasts, and fintech professionals. Today, to talk about this topic, we have with us Claire Kalamajan, who is the head of innovation, chief innovation officer at Societe Generale, a French multinational bank. We have Olaf Ransom, who is the head of CSD, the central securities depository at SIX Digital Exchange. And we have Charles Dehousie, who is the Hong Kong leader for Consensus, a leading blockchain technology firm. So all of our guests today have distinguished themselves with their work in innovation, especially on the topic of central bank digital currencies. They also cover regions such as all the way from Hong Kong, which is Charles, Switzerland, which is Olaf, and France, which is Claire. And with us, with me, I also have my co-host, the one and only Brett King. Welcome, Brett.
Charles, you've also recently been working with the Invest HK guys, promoting their sort of fintech industry out of Hong Kong as well.
Absolutely, Brett. I remember you when the fintech caravan was still on, and we were traveling all around the world from fintech events to fintech events. And indeed, I was with Invest Hong Kong, a body of the Hong Kong government, as head of fintech, and working with regulators and stakeholders over there to grow the Hong Kong fintech ecosystem.
Yeah, no, we would the fintech caravan, exactly. Yeah.
You remember the guitar and the fire and everything?
Yes. Now it's it's a bit of a shock to the system, actually. I know this year, obviously, with COVID, has been a big shift for everyone. But I did 33 countries last year, so going down to like two or three this year, it's been a big change for me personally. I can't say it's necessarily bad. Working from home has its advantages, but I do miss being on the road. So
we are recharging here all together and ready to rock and roll for 2021.
Absolutely. So we're going to be talking about central bank digital currencies today. This is largely seen as a reaction by the formal regulatory machinery around the world to the emergence of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and tokens to emerge during the ICO boom. But while there has been some efforts at sort of commercial cryptocurrencies, obviously for many in the formal banking system, currencies are a fiat based, whether that is going to be issued by a specific regulator in a specific market, or whether it's a centrally issued digital currency, the big sort of issue here is really centralized versus decentralized in many ways, privately run currency and token systems versus regulator run. And so let's talk about the state of play in respect to this. Probably the most well-known CBDC that's out there right now is the Chinese ecosystem, the Chinese digital yuan. Doesn't have a sort of formal name yet, does it? I don't think so.
It's called the DECP. I don't know what those four letters stand for. Charles, do you know?
DCP. DCP stands for Digital Currency Electronic Payment. And the reality is DCP was a name invented by the Chinese 6 years ago before any other central banks came up with CBDC, right. Central Bank Digital Currency. So the Chinese have been really working on this topic for quite a long time.
So it's more like their their acronym for the digital currency program rather than being a name. I guess everyone just sort of calls it the digital yuan, really, don't they?
Yeah, you kind of have to really like the functional name, right? So it's a very Chinese, pragmatic, very functional name. It says on the can what it does, which is really something quite interesting.
It does. And so they obviously are carving out some leadership in this respect. Let me ask you guys to sort of kick this off as a discussion, and then Arjit, you can jump in as well. But when we look at the makeup of a central bank driven program to create a digital currency like in China versus what we've seen with Ethereum, Tether, Bitcoin and so forth, XRP, you know, what are the big differences in terms of the modality or, mechanisms behind a CBDC versus an industry-led cryptocurrency?
I'd offer a view here, which is that with the central bank-led stuff, they're trying to make sure that whatever it is that they create fulfills all three purposes of money: unit of account, store of value, medium of exchange. With all the private efforts, those things have turned out to be largely things that are a bit of a gamble. And people are saying, hey, you know, is there some volatility here? And can I play this? Because the value's gone up if you take away those who, you know, have a desire for keeping away from the official systems. So I think that the Chinese effort, if I look at it, says, great, we'll go create our own. We'll set this thing up. It is, though, local to China. You can't get on the system unless you've got an account in China, and they've done it in a particular way that's there. That they think, my guess is they've got to be thinking it's enabling in two ways. It's enabling for the government in terms of control, longer term. How do we hand out money? Where does it go? Do we know what's happening? And it's probably going to trigger private sector interest in what commercial things you do offer them. So this is the Chinese taking a lead, but making sure that the thing they create fulfills those functions of money.
Yeah, the recent trial of this has been, you know, in Shenzhen has been quite interesting. They sort of just basically issued, what was it, about 150 million, 130 million?
400 million in transaction volume already.
Issued this to people around Shenzhen and said, go buy some stuff with it. It's a pretty interesting approach to getting people using a new currency, right?
And I guess, Brett, what is really outstanding from the Chinese approach, if we want to start with the Chinese CBDCs, if you look at the Western central banks, they've been mostly starting their CBDC journey out of wholesale CBDCs, wholesale use case, like how does the money move between the central banks to commercial banks. And the Chinese got a very different approach, starting with, from the get-go, with a retail CBDC. So it's a very, very different technology, very, very different architecture, very different engagement with the market, very different go-to-market strategy as well. And it's very interesting to see how different parts of the world are starting this CBDC journeys.
So where else, what are you guys watching in terms of other efforts? I know there's, some other efforts globally, but who do you think is going to fall next apart from the Chinese in respect to actually operationalizing something?
Actually, I think, France is probably the one with Europe that is next on the line, as we already started. And in April last year, that was the first worldwide transaction was operated by a subsidiary of Société Générale, Forge, that did an emission of covered bond that was directly bought back by the Banque de France and converted in digital euro. As Charles mentioned, we are talking about the wholesale CBDCs. So we are talking about a different type of approach than what we can see in China. I think most of the explanation of why Europe is taking this path versus China is also linked to the consumer appetite and the consumer needs. So I think for China, it's a way to solve for a lot of their underbanked population and to get people to use to track the digital currency on the system, where in Europe, of course, there is also underbanked population, but most of the population is equipped with a bank account, a card, and a way to track transaction and to operate day-to-day their activities. So that's one of the reasons the point of entry is different. The Europe Central Bank have just launched a consultation about retail CBDC, but it's only the beginning. And to be honest, there are other ways to solve for some of the friction, removing some of the friction that exists today in Europe, and some other projects that have been already approved.
Yeah, so Claire, I have a lot of questions about that. See, first question is, so China is already live. You know, they've done airdrops, which remind us of Ethereum projects and ICOs. And they've already done over 400 million in retail transactions. And in Europe, we are just starting to set up working groups and committees and, you know, documentation. Is this, why is that? I mean, why are we 6 years behind and still running meetings instead of actually building CBDC? Am I being too critical?
As I mentioned, I think we are starting. We've started the journey of wholesale CBDC, and I think we are in advance. We are in advance of the US, in advance of China in this area. After in retail CBDCs, it's interesting to see the current. We've seen some commercial movement. Obviously, there was all the Libra conversation in Europe that have pushed quite far the agenda and probably provoked a little bit the consultation as well, let's be honest. But I think, at the end of the day, in retail CBDC, it really go back to what does it bring for the consumer and what does it need? So obviously, we want to simplify some of the rails to move money in a secure way, instantly, and at the smaller cost possible, so everyone can live their day-to-day life as they want, run their business, operate their business. In Europe, there was about 16 banks that got together to build a program called EPI, which will provide part of this technology, including instant payment transfer, over cross countries, and already solve for part of that. So, I think it's not like we are doing nothing. So I think, yes, you're a bit critical in this sense. It's not like we are doing nothing. It's more that the evolution is a little bit different, where, we have to accept that China went with a much more disruptive approach, disruptive technology in the system.
Yeah, I think I second that completely different, approach. When you talk to the central bankers here in Europe, and I have done, I've talked to the folks at the SMB, I've talked to the folks at the ECB, they'll say, look, we've got payments today. We can do instant payments. We can do all of these things. So their concern on the retail side flips to, depending on what they do, they might disintermediate the commercial banks and create instability. And they just don't want to do that, and they're very cautious about it. So that's why there's no rush to retail generally, but you get the exception like Sweden, where they've gone, hey, we're not using as much cash as we have in the past. It's increasingly disappearing. What alternatives do we need? So retail becomes the exception rather than the norm in a lot of these developed countries. And then the central bankers that I've talked to have separated retail from wholesale. They're like, well, we can't see a reason for retail for now, but on the wholesale side, there may be reasons around all this settlement stuff that happens in the banking industry and in financial services, why we may want to do that. And that's kind of where they've drawn the line. And so you said, who might we see next? The Swiss announced that they'd be doing an experiment, and you'll see something in the press on that very shortly about what they've done. Yeah, the wholesale CBDC thing. We know that Finality is doing work with the ECB, with the Bank of England, and with the Fed to advance the cause in that area. Those are things we'll see in 2021.
So I think there's sort of two overarching sort of use cases that keep emerging when we talk about government-introduced CBDCs. And Charles, you may have a comment on this. But, obviously one is sort of tying identity into a transaction, or essentially having a traceable, auditable, currency that sort of gets around the money laundering type issues. That's one key use case. The other key use case is obviously trade. You know, we see for Russia and China doing a lot more non-USD trade now, and particularly for China, they're hoping that creating a central bank digital currency that can be used for digital type, as you say, cross-country forex type stuff, Claire. That's another strong use case that essentially will give them some sort of advantage over the petrodollar. But what are the use cases that sort of really driving this? Maybe Charles, do you want to start?
Absolutely, Brett. I think you're really spot on here. The world does not need faster money. There is fast money available all around us, either that by smart pipes or credit and settlement done by someone else. So there is a big question from the central banks I interact with in Asia on getting the right use case, so that if they build new utility with CBDCs, the adoption will be automatic. And there is so many projects from central banks, and people don't like to speak about this, where they build infrastructure, but actually the infrastructure is not bringing enough business value, and banks and different financial institutions are not migrating to this new infrastructure. So it's really critical for central banks right now to look at the technology of blockchain, and the CBDC brings value when it's actually competing in an unfair manner with fast money that is available in banks today. So I'm really precisely talking about programmable money. How can you get money which embed compliance, embed directions, and how can you get also money which is smarter in a way? So you think of use cases, if you go cross-border, let's say you're a Japanese citizen and you're investing in Korea, you might have to apply some compliance rules. And when you exit your investment in Korea, the money should be back to Japan, for example. How can you make sure that as an insurance claim, when you receive your insurance claim money, you will not be able to spend it in luxury goods purchase, but you will only be able to pay your hospital bill, for example. So these smart money use cases are really what the central banks are after, because they need to have the infrastructure right, and they need to trigger migration from the old pipes to the new pipes in order to keep their respective ecosystem effective and competitive, because it's more and more a global marketplace. And if your money is not smart enough, the money from global markets or banks will move to wherever there is more efficiency.
Yeah, so I've been reading a book called The Currency Cold War by Mr. David Birch. He's a great friend of the show. Is quite an expert on the topic. And one of the things he said is that, we're going to be moving away from this system of cards and interchange fees towards a system of multiple currencies held on mobile wallets, right? So, and these will be intelligent currencies and wallets in the sense that you can automatically pick the right money for the right use case. In some cases, it'll be Bitcoin. In some cases, it'll be an Amazon gift card. In some cases, it'll be like Xbox, Fortnite V-Bucks, which is kind of what my son uses a lot. And in some cases, it'll be the digital yuan. So who is going to get disrupted if this is the future we are looking at with central bank digital currencies and all these various forms of private money? Is it the card companies? Is it the banks? Who has the most to win or lose in this retail digital money scenario?
Let me give you my perspective first. But this is just purely as a futurist, not as a crypto expert. I'd say I'm a cryptocurrency novice in respect to this stuff, even though I've been talking about it since 2008, I guess. But the real trajectory that's interesting from a retail perspective is that all the fastest growing wallets and fastest growing payment systems in the world are mobile, and they're based off mobile value stores. Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay are a couple of those, obviously. $42 trillion in transactions last year, compared with $22.5 trillion for all of the plastic card transactions in the world. So mobile's already overtaken card. But when you look at what that means, it means that generally speaking, as we shift to these mobile wallet or cloud-based wallet ecosystems, they become the discretionary spending account. And they're driven because they can scale up much faster than physical plastic cards and physical point of sale networks. That's obviously a key part of it. But the other part of it is sort of the intelligence again coming into the mobile wallet that you're going to have that ability to have sort of contextualized financial services. So that discretionary spending account, your day-to-day spending at a retail store is clearly moving to wallets and moving away from an interchange model because the biggest wallets don't charge merchants interchange. And that's where the battle lines are being drawn. Now, obviously, in the US, they can't envisage a world without plastic cards.
Or checks.
But then they've got MasterCard and Visa who are heavily incentivized not to change that system. But that's why I often say that by 2030, I think everyone's going to be on Chinese mobile wallets is because they aren't making that change themselves. So that's sort of systemically, it's really you go into a smarter bank account. We talk about smarter money. A smarter bank account is that sort of contextual mobile wallet that adjusts to your needs in real time, including access to credit or behavioral savings modalities and things like that. So that's the broad change that's happening from a day-to-day bank account perspective as it morphs into mobile wallets. And the fact that most of the unbanked who will come into the system will come in on mobile wallets rather than a traditional value store from a bank.
Are you saying that the wallets are the new banks?
Well, no, they're the new discretionary spending account. But that doesn't, they have to take deposits, but they don't need to be banks necessarily. You could look at it as a smart store of value. Right. But then again, this whole question, we could get into the whole IPO thing and should they be regulated as an FI or should they be regulated as a technology company? That's a whole topic for a different show.
I think it depends. But so Claire, I have a question for you at this point. Right. So as someone who leads innovation.
Well, we missed Olaf there. He had a point to make, I think.
That's a wonderful perspective on retail, and I get the wallet and the discretionary thing. And I think what I do with Revolut and my son when he's at university in the UK, and we use that to feed him. So I kind of get that. That makes perfect sense. On the wholesale side, there's a different dynamic, and the dynamic is the industry's buying into the idea that assets will get tokenized using new tech, which is the DLT tech, and the logic of having DLT tech says, well, it turns out that distributed ledger is really good when you need to collaborate. And guess what? Banks have a whole load of collaboration stuff to do in wholesale. Mm-hmm. It's this thing called settlement. We bought and sold things and we need to exchange goods and money. And banks have to do a lot of this. It's kind of almost unique to financial services. You don't have to do this anywhere else. And there's a great promise from DLT that the next wave of technology is DLT based, therefore collaboration gets easier, therefore the costs go down, better, faster, cheaper. If that's true, then here comes the challenge. Oh, we've moved the asset, but where's the payment? We need to have a solution for payment that's on the same technology, because otherwise we've got to take all the new stuff and integrate it to the old stuff. But hang on, the reason we wanted to do the new stuff was to get past all the inefficiencies and the frictions and costs of the old stuff. So that having to mix the two would make no sense. It would just leave the banks relatively as inefficient as they are today, and they're massively inefficient. So we kind of need to evolve both things, the asset and the payment.
Right. So Olaf, you and I both worked briefly with the Bank of England, and our great friend Andrew Hauser went on record saying that the real-time gross settlement system will not be on a blockchain, but it'll be blockchain compatible. So
I don't think I can let completely Olaf to say that banks are massively inefficient. I think what is sure is and that what you are seeing with Forge and this type of technology is that for sure we can implement new technology rails which ensure more security, more transparency, and a system which is built differently. Now there is no other way than the way it's done today, and I'm still waiting for a financial coach or for a complex operation to be done by my mobile wallet. I look at that quite often in terms of how do we digitize part of the private bank operations and some of the commercial bank operation. I can tell you that people still want to talk to a human to make sure the deal is moving forward, and that we, part of the journey will be digitized, it's not the case. But what it shows is what we see in terms of product in CBDC wholesale, which are emerging. So in Forge, we deal principally in the primary market. Then you have a bunch of things on the secondary market, and as mentioned, Olaf, in tokenization. And then we have part of the custody assets, which are starting to be tested. And in Europe, there is some banks also that are online digital, which we have a partnership with, which are testing this type of area. I think, it's fair to recognize it's still a very early day. I'm sure even in a, yes, there is a digital UN, but even in a, when you start going in the use case, it's still very early, and collaboration is critical. That's what we believe in SocGen, and that's also when we build the SG open protocol, we open source it through Forge, because it's something that at the end of the day will require a lot of factors, as a lot of different actors, as Olaf just mentioned.
Thanks, Claire. Well, listen, I've got a few questions that come off that, but before we get to that, let's take a quick break. You're listening to this special edition on central bank digital currencies from around the world. We are at Breaking Banks, and we'll be right back after these words from our sponsors.
Have things been a little bit chaotic for you lately? Well, you're not alone. 2020 was a year of uncertainty. And part of that means it can be so busy to even find the talent you need to get ahead, you just don't have time. That's why we use Fiverr, an online marketplace that connects businesses with freelancers offering hundreds of digital services, including graphic design, copywriting, web programming, film editing, and more. Why I like Fiverr? I can customize my search. We can find someone with the exact talents. We can see the reviews. We can see the work products that they've done for others. And we know we've got Fiverr standing behind us with 24/7 customer service. We use Fiverr all of the time to get highly tailored services doing exactly what we need. Check out Fiverr, FIVERR.com, and receive 10% off your first order by using my code BREAKING. Breaking as in Breaking Banks at Fiverr, FIVERR.com, and receive 10% off. Find all the digital services you need in one place using the code BREAKING. Again, Fiverr, FIVERR.com with the code BREAKING.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
The Finovate podcast is your home for interesting conversations and insights from Finovate's global conference series. I'm Greg Palmer. Join me as I interview leading innovators, bankers, analysts, venture capitalists, and more to get their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Find us wherever you normally listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Welcome to the Breaking Banks Central Bank Digital Currency Special. It's quite a hot topic, and we have so many questions. We could go on all day, but we're not going to do that. So from the previous segment, I have two specific questions for Olaf and for Claire. So we'll start with Claire. So, we talked about this future where we're going to move away from cards and interchange fees to wallets, intelligent wallets and programmable money tokens, right? Now, what's your plan as a commercial bank to sort of prepare for that future? Or isn't that quite a disruptive force? I went to Money20 23 years ago, and I asked a question: if I already have an Ethereum account, why do I need a bank account? So we're not going to go that far. But if I have tokenized programmable money, how does that affect banks, and how do banks cope with that?
Yes, so I think, you know, as I mentioned before, it's still very early days. So obviously, the consultation of the ECB on the retail money on the retail CBDC have started. What we can observe today is private money, and we talked a little bit before about Libra. So there is some operations, GAFAM, fintechs, which are starting to offer some product proposition for a consumer to privatize part of their net wealth. Obviously, you know, it's still very uncertain, and I think Olaf was mentioning it, so I'm not, you know, I'm just repeating his words, but there are consequences and systemic risk that will be introduced by this type of proposition when they are not regulated. And that's why, from a point of view of Société Générale, we look mostly at programs that are under supervision of the central banks. And we've done the program with the Banque de France on CBDC wholesale. We do contribute for CBDC retail. If there is consumer appetite, you know, clearly there is a need to look further. You know, in the bank, I chair innovation committees with all our management, where we regularly review our point of view and our approaches to this different new technology, new shift. But so far, you know, the population using programmable money or doing this type of things is not expressing a huge need to go towards that. So again, we go back in the situation between China and Europe. So, as I mentioned, banks have taken already steps towards the program EPI to really get together to offer a proposition that would be game-changing in the future.
Right. So we're not seeing as much of a consumer need for some of the future we're talking about right now. Okay. Now, Olaf, so you talked about delivery versus payment and, you know, and the value of sort of distributed ledger technology in sort of helping banks coordinate settlement in a network, right? Now, Andrew Houser of the Bank of England said a couple of years ago that the RTGS will the new RTGS will be blockchain compatible, but will not be built on distributed ledger technology. So how do you create this interoperability, you know, using CBDC, central bank digital currency, between the types of settlement, the securities ledgers you're building at the Swiss Digital Exchange and the central bank's off-chain tokenized wholesale CBDCs?
Right. So I can understand how a couple of years ago, Andrew Houser would make a comment like that. That's right up there with the old adage from my youth that said no one ever got shot for buying IBM. Like when the technology's evolving, everybody was still buying IBM when client server came along. And I can tell you from some of our own experience at SDX and some of the deliberations that I'm now party to having joined, you can see a sea change in what we understood 2 years ago as perceived wisdom and what today's is. So if a week is a long time in politics, 2 weeks or 2 years around fintech is a hell of a long time. So I'd say jury's slightly out on that one, but I'd understand why a central bank says RTGS won't be built on distributed ledger. An RTGS in its current format can't readily serve all the things we need in a new tokenized asset environment. And one of the biggest problems is around peer-to-peer. So the whole tokenized thing is moving to peer-to-peer assets. Yet our RTGS systems are based on narrow access, quite narrow. Central bank's customer list is very narrow.
Clearing just bank.
For those listening that aren't familiar with it, RTGS is a real-time gross settlement system. So it's basically the real-time ability to settle payments, make sure that it goes from one account to another with the proper credit and debit, right?
Thank you. Yeah. So that's the thing that moves the big amounts of money around and does all the stuff in the so-called wholesale banking environment. Payment systems generally have access rules and they're quite limited. And I always use the same example from down here in my past. My friends at Credit Suisse, where I used to work many years ago, they have access to central bank reserves in Swiss francs. They don't in dollars, pounds, euros, and all the rest. And they have to rely on a correspondent bank. And we have this tiering system. This tiering system has for the longest time been an increasing concern for the regulators because the only way payments get made is if the banks acting as correspondents are willing to take large amounts of intraday credit risk. And this is a real concern. We have a chance to change that order as we move to a new setup. And the RTGS system has some role to play in that, but that alone is probably not sufficient to power all the things we need in the tokenized asset world. I'll stop there rather than belabor the point, I think.
Is it okay to disagree in Breaking Banks?
Oh, of course.
Oh, yes.
So that's fantastic.
I disagree with that.
I think we are focusing here on faster money. And what I see from central banks we interact with and at Consensus, we've got four projects running right now, one with Société Générale in France, one with the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, another one with the Bank of Thailand, another one with the Reserve Bank of Australia, and many other conversations running. Just to come back to some of the comments made earlier, I think no one was expecting the iPhone when Apple launched the iPhone. We were very happy with the Nokia phone. And we were not aware of what we would get with true groundbreaking technology. So money is working today. We don't need faster money. But the reality is there is some people, there is some countries, there is some technologists which are building the new kind of money. And it's going to be in your wallet without you realizing. That's number one. And then when we look at different central banks we interact with, or different markets we interact with, and at Consensus we have a global footprint, we see two different trends. One trend is the regulators, central banks looking at evaluating the technology. And some other people are looking at finding the right use case, finding a product market fit with a use case, and then after that, trying to kind of surface the technology which will enable that. So we need to really, look at the global market and thinking there is some local needs, there is some local trends, there is some local pace to integrate with this new technologies and opportunities. And there is no one CBDC fits all. We can speak about CBDC in a political manner. We can think about CBDC in cross-border. There is not much cross-border in Europe because Europe is one single market now. But other parts of the world need CBDC for cross-border. So it's a very exciting and energizing topic which needs to have, as per today, many different views and market experience.
So Charles, thank you for that impassioned talk. You know, I'm already a believer. So, Olaf, this is a question for you, right? You worked on an incredible initiative called the Finality, right? The utility settlement coin. So, if you were already building interoperable digital commercial bank money held by central banks that could be used for settlement and for a variety of payment schemes and to unlock liquidity, what does wholesale CBDC add on top of Finality?
Ideally, in any one currency, you'd have either or. Would be my first statement. One of the risks we run in any currency is fragmenting liquidity. We already do that in a variety of different ways, particularly on the wholesale side of life. Banks have got money all over the place, and that causes lots of friction, causes lots of need for intraday overdrafts. So the Finality project, as it was conceived, was supposed to give impetus to say we need to solve for payment in the digital asset environment with tokenized assets. I think if I would represent as best I could the views of the banks who are involved in that, it was like, fine. The answer could be we do it as a reserve-backed digital currency, or it could be like the Swiss now turn up and go, hey, we'll try out, and they've experimented with a wholesale variety, a wholesale CBDC. No promise yet that goes to production. That's just an experiment. So I think you have to look on the bank's efforts in that USC project as pioneering and trying to point the way to say, hey, if we believe in tokenized assets, you better solve for cash. Back to the problem I talked about a couple of minutes earlier that said, if the platform for the asset is new, you don't want to integrate that back to all the legacy technology. So I'd say the banks would be pretty indifferent.
I think... I've got a real question here is that if, you're looking at the next generation of money, right, because that's what we're really talking about here, how would you design money for the world we live in today? You know, the problem with the current system in terms of fiat currencies is not really one of value stores, it's one of value exchange. And it's, Olaf, you talk about settlement systems and so forth. But in a digital world, geographical boundaries to a currency or a geographical definition of a currency doesn't really make much sense in the world we live in. So why haven't we seen more of a sort of effort by central banks to come together and create a cross-border proof, non-geographical, digital currency? Why are we having to have individual, geographical efforts? Like, why are we just digitizing fiat currencies instead of, really creating a currency that's boundless, that can work efficiently on the digital, sphere rather than just sort of redoing geographical constraints, which don't make any sense in the digital world?
So completely with you on the geographical constraints, and cross-border is indeed a big problem. It's cross-border payments, cross-border settlements that caused a lot of the issue. Why have we not got a common currency? See the euro and what a mess that is with the fools that run the EU. Definitely not.
Oh, here we go. Thing. We don't want to get into the whole.
Hey, I'm sitting in Switzerland. We don't like the EU, right? We didn't like the euro idea, and we definitely do
I'm
not
British
like
now.
The EU.
That's a good conversation. No, but I think, Fred, to be fair, part of it is also linked to our sovereign agenda. I mean, like, that's the same right. conversation. Or why are we not? Why is there a conversation at the moment where European countries don't want to use American cloud or Chinese cloud? It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it's a tension between the globalization and the digitalization that go with it, and local movements, local economies, and how they structure themselves. And I think we cannot just look at the problem to say, okay, and I think Charles mentioned it, a lot of these programs, by central bank, some are operational. We talked about Banque de France. We talked about, I think, HK is quite advanced and China is in train. Some other, they have talked about it for quite a long time now and nothing have come out of it. So it's not so easy. The power is not only with the central banks to make this decision, and their intention may not be, as I mentioned, for a sovereign perspective to really go and create this currency, because who will control it? How we will maintain it? How do we ensure at the end of the day, yes, there is technology breakthroughs that are important, and I don't think Charles and I disagreed about the iPhone thing. I think, we go right in the tokenized asset we forge, so I think we are quite mature about it. But
yeah,
it's all about the use cases and what you do. Sorry.
On that note, I have a question for Brett. Brett, you work a lot with the Chinese firms, and in China, you've done a lot of work in China. So, David Birch talks about how the tyranny of the US dollar in his book, and how the US sanctions had a significant impact on some of the large Chinese firms this year, and how US sanctions have really, been a bit of a limiting force for financial inclusion and a number of other, things that we want to achieve through this digital money. So is that a big driver in your view for the digital yuan? And you see that as part of China's soft power and financial power in the world that's coming? And then, what's the imperative for the US and Europe off the back of that?
Well, the imperative for the US is they want to retain control in a world that's increasingly disparate, they don't really have the moral imperative anymore for sort of managing the world's financial systems, nor do they have the innovation that's necessary. Mm-hmm. Lobbying infrastructure in the United States has slowed down innovation in the fintech arena. The US is clearly slipping behind China. I'm disappointed that the Ant IPO didn't go more smoothly, because that really would have flagged
the Ant Financial IPO.
Ant Group, Ant Technology, Ant Financial. We're not sure what they're called anymore. Because that would have really flagged significantly, having this largest privately owned company in the world, a fintech, now worth more than all but two or three banks in the world would have been a very big statement, right? Fortunately, it was also a statement that was challenging to banks in China, and so hence we see the Chinese ecosystem pushing back there. But it would have made a big statement to the US. But the bigger issue is on trade. You know, as we push towards a climate responsible economy and a sort of a reformed version of capitalism over the next few years, 50% of commodities trade globally today is around the petrodollar, is around energy. So trades in oil and gas and coal. And obviously that's going to be dramatically impacted by our shift to renewables. And so at the heart of the dominance of the US dollar is trade around, fossil fuels, which is definitely going to be impacted. Mm-hmm. And so the US really doesn't have a plan for that. Right now, although the change in administration may bring some of that on. You really have the U.S. Is focused on continuing U.S. Dollar hegemony, and China wants to attack that. But there needs to be some bigger and badder goals here. And I think, like Claire, a green or energy sustainable, environmentally sustainable global digital currency would be a very honorable aim. If we could, start penalizing people for using, currencies that aren't, energy efficient. So, for example, maybe we have LinkedIn to, instead of having a basket of fiat currencies underwriting, a central bank digital currency, why don't we have other aims like, whether the economy is carbon net neutral or whether it creates financial inclusivity, these things could be built into the design of a central bank digital currency. I just don't think we're going far enough right now. I think we're just trying to replicate, physical currency under a digital template rather than being really revolutionary. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, so I'll just bring up my pesky, Twitter persona for a second. And so Claire, you said that, there isn't an obvious consumer need. So what's the rush? We're going to take our time, really study what we're trying to build, and then, work together as banks and build something over a period of time and eventually get there. Whereas what I'm hearing from Brett now is that, there's a sense of urgency around this because, whoever's digital money essentially gains traction around the world, whether it's Africa or elsewhere in South America or so on, will have a significant advantage in terms of, geopolitical power. So
if you're tied into mobile wallets, yeah, and energy trade, yeah.
Indeed. So shouldn't we be trying a little bit harder and moving a bit faster in Europe?
Maybe, Ajit, the CBDCs will be like a wake-up call for many of the fintech innovation in brackets. Maybe when you will have M0 money coming straight out of the central banks with embedded functionalities such as cross-border or automatic swap between currencies or embedded KYCs, a lot of the fintech weak proposition might fade out. So this might be a good wake-up call for many of the innovators, some of the banks, and some of the people from the industry, when they will be essentially fueled by a new and smarter money. And I guess this is what we are seeing in Asia, notably in China, where some VCs are kind of very worried about their portfolio because they realize that the central banks now is kind of flushing the market with very smart money, with functionalities which used to be covered by some fintech, and this fintech value proposition is being challenged.
Yeah, I think there's a limit to how far that you can go with the revolutionary part. So I think, yes, you can make digital currency more available on the retail level up to a point. And you can say, hey, it's okay, we'll let agent have $200 in his wallet without doing all the KYC and all the rest of it. But to Claire's point about sovereignty, whoever owns that currency is going to want to impose the same rules where there's the same business and the same risks. And that message is loud and clear from all the central banks. So you're going to see something that's dollars, something that's euro, something that's pound, something that's Swiss franc with the right sovereignty over it. And you're not going to have too much leeway to create anything that we'd later regret. And I can see at some bottom level everyone saying, yeah, Ajit can have 200 Swiss francs, who cares? No problem.
Yeah, but so I'm an Indian immigrant. I'm an Indian immigrant who is now a British citizen, right? So our money, and now our money is British money, used to be very popular all over India once upon a time. And now India has gone ahead and built a payment system which relies on digital identity, Aadhaar, and APIs, that's UPI. There is no token, no digital currency, and that payment system is working beautifully. Anyone can get a bank account. So I think to some extent, I'm also aligned with Claire's view, which is, if all we are solving is for payments, and especially domestic payments, then do we really need a retail CBDC? It's not clear. But I think then this whole geopolitical angle comes up. So, Brett, you've been talking about a very, very interesting project recently, right? I mean, a truly futuristic. And I think there are some implications there for how we should design this new form of
money.
You're
talking about the ELOT.
That's right. It's the ELOT.
Do you guys know what the ELOT is?
ELOT.
It's my central bank digital currency for Mars. It's an electronic lot of value, but it sounds a lot like Elon, of course, the first Lord Emperor of Mars. But I was trying to think about, you know, if we're going to create a new currency and a new economy for Mars, it has to be first principles, right? It has to be from scratch built for the Martian economy. And would you build a currency that works, or an economic system that works like, the capitalist system on Earth? And the answer is no. If you look at, there's some really good work on this, right? Been done by Kim Stanley Robinson, an author who wrote the Mars trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, and he's now written a book called The Ministry of the Future, which I strongly recommend everyone on here to read. It talks about how climate change is going to change sort of globalization and governance and so forth. But if we're going to create a currency for Mars, its ultimate aim should be to help Mars become self-sustainable and not necessarily be driven by commerce or trade, right? It should be geared towards trade or commerce that specifically promotes the goal of self-sustainability for Mars. So how would you do that? Well, you'd create a currency that's strongly aligned with resource usage on the planet, so that people that create resources that sustain the Martian economy would get more wealth. And people that burn through, use currency without that, virtuous circle would be in debt. So that's something a little different that I'd like to talk about. But for another episode, what's the Martian economy going to look like? But the point is, if you were going to design a new currency from scratch, really design a new currency from scratch, I think it would be very different from the currencies we're used to seeing, over the last few hundred years. And I think maybe we're not thinking big enough.
Brett, you sound ready for decentralized finance. You should spend more time over there and explore the experimentation of this space.
Yeah, let's work on it together, man. You know, what do you think? Let me finish off with this, because we've got to finish up. But can I ask you guys, what do you think is the most radical central bank digital currency proposition that's out there right now?
I think
let's start with
Claire. Not there yet. You've made us dream now. You know,
yeah, we're not radical enough.
Everything you see is not meeting your expectation.
Charles?
I live in Hong Kong. I spend a lot of time with Chinese counterparts, and I go with the Chinese one. And I give you maybe the 1 minute pitch about the Chinese DCEP, the Chinese CBDC, why it's different. The Chinese CBDC comes with a very simple story. It's one token. One token is equal to 1 yuan. It's a legal tender.
Yeah.
The second part of the story is it's two accounts. This token is always living between two accounts, either between central banks and commercial banks and individual between individuals. So simple formula so far, one token, two accounts. And the third part of the story is three centers. And the Chinese have designed a CBDC, which is a token, which lives independently always between two accounts and relies on three centers. One center for AML to make sure that the money is not spent into illegal activities. One center for the general accounting, making sure that if you spend there, there is a plus and minus down and everyone, every account is square. And the third part is a big part of analytics to start to understand as a central banks, where is your money being spent? Where is the money? And how you can impact your economy and how the economy is going. So some kind of dashboard for the economy, which is not really available for central banks. So to come back to your question, I think it's one of the very early CBDC, but by design, it's a very interesting and very ambitious design.
Wow, that's fascinating. Olaf?
Well, we got to wrap up, don't we, Ajit? How can we stay in touch with you guys if for our listeners who are listening to the show, social media, Twitter feeds, LinkedIn, what's the best way, Claire, to keep in touch with you?
LinkedIn, Twitter, definitely up there.
And your Twitter handle?
It's CCALMEJA.
Very good. And Olaf?
On LinkedIn, the Banker's Plumber is the thing to look up. That makes me relatively easy to find. I use a similar handle on Twitter, but I'm less of a Twitter user. But if you look up the Banker's Plumber, you'll find me.
Very good. And Charles?
You can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn at Charles Dossi in one word. And Brett, can I get your address? I want to send you by Christmas my new book. It's called Block Kong. Blockchain in Hong Kong. It's 21 interviews about 21 blockchain entrepreneurs, and I'm sure you're going
to
like it.
Sure, yeah, we'll do some coverage of it on the show if we can too. So love to see that, Charles. So
I want one, Charles, for my Christmas.
Get one, Claire.
You know, I never got one, Charles. I mean, it should be on the blockchain.
All right, so Ajit. Ajit, you want to take us out? You want to close?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'd like to thank our guests for sharing such diverse and comprehensive perspectives. We got Olaf from the wholesale CBDC and market infrastructure perspective. We got Claire to talk about our, you know, the banking, commercial banking and the retail customer perspective. And then we finally had Charles coming from a leading technology infrastructure company that seems to be doing, that is really doing a lot in this, in the CBDC space. We didn't have the time to cover Libra and my favorite Ethereum and Bitcoin, but we'll do that at some other point. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and thank you so much to our guests for joining us today for this extremely exciting topic. Thanks again. Thanks, Brett.
That's Breaking Banks. We'll see you guys next week.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.